This is David Barsamian, and welcome to Alternative Radio. This edition of AR features Anthony Arnov and Janine Jackson on American empire and corporate media. Hermann Göring, second in command to Hitler, said, and I'm quoting, "Naturally, the common people don't want war. It is the leaders of the country who determine policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country." Today we see the patterns that Göring described replicated in the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the war on terrorism. Corporate media have been instrumental in manufacturing consent for war. Our guests today are Anthony Arnov and Janine Jackson. We're all in Taos, New Mexico, at the annual Taos Talking Picture Festival, which not only features standard feature films and documentaries, but also has a media forum. Anthony Arnov is editor of the international bestseller Iraq Under Siege. He lectures frequently on U.S. foreign policy and the Middle East. Janine Jackson is program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, the New York-based Media Watch Group, and she's co-host of FAIR's weekly program, Counterspin. Welcome to the program, Anthony Arnov.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Janine Jackson.
Very happy to be here, David.
Well, I'd like your comments on the idea of American empire and corporate media. Traditionally, empire is not usually attached with the adjective American. We hear a lot about the British Empire and the French Empire and empires of the past, but is this a time to be talking about American empire?
Absolutely. I think right now we see the United States asserting an imperial control on the global stage, which actually rivals any empire in human history. You have to go back to the time of the Romans to really find anything remotely comparable. But today we see an American empire which has weapons far more powerful and has a reach, in fact, far larger than any we've ever seen before. And the consequences are really extreme. We see the United States using in Iraq, I think, a preemptive attack on another country which couldn't possibly match it militarily as a demonstration war, as an effort to say, we will call the shots on the global stage. Anyone who looks us the wrong way, this could happen to you, and we will police the world. We will dominate the world. We'll do it economically. We'll also do it militarily.
And to add to that, you also have, as you alluded to with that Göring quote, you also have the administration attempting very overtly to manage public opinion so that they appear to have, we're a democracy after all, so that they can appear to have the people behind them as they go forward in this imperial enterprise. Unfortunately, while we have a nominally free press, the corporate media in this country have been acting particularly since September 11th, 2001, but it, of course, goes back beyond that, have basically been acting as frictionless transmitters for the Bush administration view. We have not seen a real debate about White House policy on the war on Iraq any more than we saw it on the war on Afghanistan. We're not getting a range of perspectives, and so people are basically only hearing the White House view. So even if they would want to question that or challenge that, they're not getting the information on which to make that challenge.
Your organization, FAIR, actually conducted a survey of the experts who appear on the network news shows. What information did you come up with?
This was perhaps the most dramatic illustration of the lack of debate on the Iraq war in the mainstream news media. We looked at 2 weeks of coverage of nightly network news and also the PBS NewsHour. Most strikingly, we found that fully 76% of sources on Iraq, 76 or three quarters, were former or current government officials. I think that's a very dramatic finding. Obviously, there's not going to be a lot of room left over for a whole range of perspectives, international law experts, regional experts on the Middle East, folks who could talk about the humanitarian impact. We're hearing overwhelmingly one view, and that is the view of the U.S. government.
Yeah, the question of who is determined to be an expert in debating Iraq is really a significant feature of coverage of this war. I'll just give one example. If you were to watch NBC's coverage of the war, you would have heard frequently from Barry McCaffrey. Barry McCaffrey was a general in the first Gulf War. He's also part of a group called the Committee for Iraqi Liberation, which is a network of people who have been actively pushing this policy of intervention in Iraq to engineer regime change. And another NBC media commentator, Colonel Wayne Downing, is also part of the same outfit. So we have people who have staked their careers and who have financial and commercial interests in this war being presented as if they were neutral policy commentators and as if they are the people who can really provide us insight into what the United States is doing in Iraq. They have an ideological stake in it. They're quite partisan. And also, increasingly, we see people who have a financial stake in this war being involved in the debate, or so-called debate, really, that's taking place.
In the U.S. invasions of Grenada and Panama in the 1980s, and then again in the first Gulf War, the media were kept virtually in a lockbox, and this was criticized by many journalists. In the second Gulf War, 2003, hundreds of corporate media reporters were, quote, embedded with U.S. troops, and their reports have saturated the airwaves and newsprint as well. What's your assessment of their performance?
The embedded reporters thing is at best a double-edged sword. I think you definitely want reporters to be able to be on site when there are things going on. You want them to be able to get near the front, near the action, without endangering themselves or others, obviously, but to be witnesses to the war. That's very important. But what folks need to understand about this embedding process is those reporters are working under pretty serious restrictions. They have signed on to essentially the Pentagon rules for how they may report, which means they are not allowed to go off independently by themselves and talk to whoever they want without military officials standing by. And another part of the policy is that no service people that these reporters speak to can ever be off the record. Everyone must be named. Well, it's pretty common sense that a soldier is not going to give you critical information or talk openly about worries or concerns that they might have if they know they have to give their name and if they have to have a higher official nearby as they make that statement. So, and the embedded reporters have been good at bringing us some immediacy, but at the same time, they have very predictably been very caught up in the day-to-day and showing us positive, glowing reports of U.S. forces and British forces going about their business. Unfortunately, they have tended to kind of bog down into that day-to-day stuff, so we're seeing a lot of, here's a Marine cleaning his gear, here's a new gun that they have, here's what the tanks look like rolling down this road. That's all very interesting, but it doesn't go anywhere near the bigger questions that need to be asked about the invasion. So embedded reporters can bring us a certain kind of story, and they're doing that, but that is only a slice of the story here. So they really are not asking some fundamental questions, which frankly could be asked from Washington, D.C. in a Pentagon press briefing. You don't have to be out in the field to ask some of the serious questions that need to be asked.
Just to add to what Janine's saying, a number of journalists have commented on this. Christopher Hedges from the New York Times wrote a very perceptive analysis of the impact of embedding journalists, and he said that the embedding of several hundred journalists in military units does not diminish the lie of war. These journalists do not have access to their own transportation. They depend on the military for everything, from food to a place to sleep. They look to the soldiers around them for protection. When they feel their fear of hostile fire, they identify and seek to protect those who protect them. They become part of the team. It's a natural reaction. I have felt it. And he goes on to say that the journalists become participants in the war effort, which I think is a very important insight. They want to do their bit, he continues, and their bit is the dissemination of myth, the myth used to justify war and boost the morale of the soldiers and civilians. And really, that's what we've seen. We've seen reporting, which is like home team sports coverage, rooting on the troops, providing something that will boost morale, that will boost the morale of people at home, boost the morale of soldiers. And when journalists, honest journalists with integrity, have gone out into the field to try to report critically on the war, to do the stories that we need to be hearing, they've gotten flack. They've been attacked. And we've seen a number of journalists in this conflict fired or threatened, not only by higher-ups in their news organizations, but by the political forces waging this war.
Most notably, Peter Arnett, who was reporting for both GE's NBC as well as the Microsoft NBC station, MSNBC. Can you recount the Arnett incident? Arnett is a New Zealand native. He reported with a lot of notoriety during the first Gulf War, and his credentials go back to Vietnam, actually.
What happened most recently with Peter Arnett is that he gave an interview to Iraqi TV. And for many people, that on the face of it was a transgression, simply to talk to Iraqi TV. As Arnett put it, he was returning a favor for folks that he had interviewed many times. Now, I actually don't believe there's a problem with a reporter speaking their mind in an interview. I certainly don't think there is simply a problem automatically with giving an interview to Iraqi TV. Personally, I have some questions about some of the comments that Peter Arnett made, but it's interesting that the questions that I have are not the ones being raised. My concern was more his crediting the Iraqi government with great openness and allowing him access and allowing reporters access to information. That reads to me a little bit like a beet sweetener, the kind of thing that a reporter says to a source that they rely on regularly to be sort of friendly. I think that was somewhat questionable. But interestingly, that has not been what folks have glommed onto or what folks have pointed to for the reason for his firing. It was simply that it was unpatriotic of him to speak in any way critically of the war effort, to say there were problems with it, even though this was something that others were saying at the time. One of the most interesting and depressing aspects of the Arnett story to me is that after he was fired, we had folks saying, well, you know, he came with a lot of baggage because, after all, he had reported a lot on civilian casualties in the first Gulf War. Well, reporting on civilian casualties is not baggage. It's journalism.
I think the story about civilian casualties is crucial to coverage of this war. The United States political apparatus tried to make it seem as if anyone who reported on casualties was glorifying the war. And so, for example, you saw criticism of Al Jazeera and other Arab networks for showing the reality of this war, for going to villages that had been bombed, for going to families who had lost loved ones, interviewing them. They were condemned as glorifying the war, as making it seem that it was that the United States was deliberately targeting civilians, when in reality they were reporting something that the U.S. media didn't want to touch, which is that the United States was using military technology that, however developed, however smart those weapons might be, was having a profound impact on the civilian population of Iraq. A number of missiles went astray in this war. We saw missiles go into Iran, go into Jordan. We saw missiles also hit a number of civilian infrastructures, hit homes. In one case hit a hospital. And that was a story that the U.S. media did not want to focus on. The other part of the war that I think we should talk about is the military PR base that was set up in Qatar. The United States spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to engineer a press center in Doha, Qatar, where a stage was designed by the person who designed sets for Good Morning America, who also designed a set for the illusionist David Blaine. And it was a very carefully orchestrated attempt to package news for the media. And again there, the images that were broadcast at the Doha Center were images of only those favorable strikes that the United States wanted the media to report, wanted to see on American news channels, not the stories of missiles that went astray, not the stories of civilian suffering, not the stories about the lack of water and electricity in Basra. And I think that was as important a part of the coverage of this war as the embedding of journalists.
This is an administration that is, they're professionals at managing opinion. They understand that shaping public opinion is going to be crucial to their other efforts. And so things like that communication center that they set up in Qatar, they made it very clear, they were quite overt about it, that they were going to be pumping out the White House message. There would be a morning statement, there would be things out in the afternoon, in the evening they would have other briefings for reporters. They basically said 24 hours a day, we're going to be giving reporters something to report from our perspective. Essentially, we're going to fill up their day. That, to me, to a real journalist, ought to read as a challenge. When an administration says, we have a line we want you to report, and we're going to be pushing that line on you very aggressively, shouldn't a journalist say, well then, I'm going to be questioning that. I'm going to be looking outside of these briefings to get real information. I'm always drawn back to a comment that was made by an unnamed military official to Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post. This was in the fall of 2001, not long after September 11th. A military official told Howard Kurtz, this is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. He meant at this point the war on terrorism, this ill-defined, open-ended thing. This is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. We're going to lie about things. This is a statement that appeared in the Washington Post, you know, made by an official to a reporter. These folks are overt about it, and it seems to me that that should be read as a challenge to journalists.
I think absolutely. This idea that the government is willing to lie has become common parlance in the Bush administration. George Bush spoke about the fact that in the war on terrorism, they will fight wars that we will not know about. In other words, covert operations that they will deliberately keep from the public. They've also talked about propaganda war as an element of this war in Iraq and as an element of every intervention that they're taking part in. That is, that there's a deliberately conscious media component. Satellite broadcasts, radio broadcasts, the dropping of these leaflets into Iraq, but also targeting the media at home as a source of propaganda to try to get them, in the few cases where they're not already serving as an echo chamber, to serve as a relay for the White House's message of the day. And I think that we're very likely going to discover, when historians look back on this period, more examples like we saw in the past of the U.S. government planting stories, using journalists for covert operations and to get a message out to the media, which is deliberate falsification of and is part of a propaganda effort that the United States is engaged in.
When I watch the TV news, reports from Al Jazeera TV as well as Abu Dhabi TV are clearly labeled in the upper right-hand corner. There's always a graphic. I don't recall seeing too many graphics saying Department of Defense TV or Supply. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right, and it's really illustrative. The way that U.S. corporate media have treated outlets like Al Jazeera has been really interesting. For example, when they are reporting something or relaying something that Al Jazeera has talked about, it will always be bracketed. It will always be qualified as, according to Al Jazeera, we were not able to confirm this. And yet, they will relay everything that Donald Rumsfeld says. We very rarely, virtually never, hear them say, well, the Pentagon has made this claim, but we were not able to confirm it ourselves. There's an understanding that somehow, when you're hearing about Al Jazeera, you need to always question whether it's propagandistic, whether it's baseless. You have to really take it with a grain of salt. But the corollary does not apply. When you hear from the Pentagon, you're meant to simply accept that as truth. That's not just troubling as a principle. It's also especially troubling because, after all, we have a very vivid and recent history of the Pentagon and other administration offices making claims that turned out not to be true. So journalists have reported things that didn't pan out from the Pentagon, and yet each new Pentagon claim is treated as gospel despite the history.
And if you look at the images we did see on our television screens, we saw American flags flying on the network logos of almost every major television station. We also saw reporters at Fox encouraging the U.S. military to bomb Iraqi television and then boasting that they were thrilled when that finally happened. So you had a situation where Fox Television was, in essence, campaigning for a military strategy of targeting journalists, targeting media outlets in order to shut down their propaganda apparatus, whereas they were quite openly pleased to be part of the U.S. war propaganda apparatus and scarcely tried to mask it as objective journalism.
Fox Network, owned by the News Corporation, owned by Rupert Murdoch, one of the top six corporations that dominate most of the media in the world. Talk a little bit about how language is used, particularly at a time of war. Such phrases as collateral damage have now kind of seeped into the aquifer and are repeated constantly. Targets of opportunity, decapitation strikes, things like that.
There is a tremendous emphasis on using terms that sanitize what's going on. It's very Dr. Strangelove, you know. To talk about children dying as collateral damage is simply perverse. It confuses us about what's really going on. And at the same time, we're hearing terms like precise and surgical about airstrikes, for example, that are in no way precise or surgical, that in fact have, as Anthony has said, have strayed off target, have killed civilians even when they've hit the military target. So again, this is language that has an influence on people. We are doing something precise and surgical, and if anything bad happens, well, it's collateral damage. It's not children dying in the street. And I think it does have a tremendous influence. Even things like MSNBC has adopted as their logo for their coverage Operation Iraqi Freedom. They have simply lifted the Bush administration's name for the invasion and used it as their own name for their coverage. And that's not obviously a neutral label. Iraqi Freedom is a highly ideological label, and yet that language has been adapted as a kind of neutral descriptor of what's going on here.
Rush Limbaugh, who reaches, according to his publicists, millions of American radio listeners all over the country, on April 9th on a Clear Channel-owned KOA radio station in Denver, he was exultant, full of what he said, pride and joy over what has been achieved. The conquest of Iraq is a roadmap. Roadmap, he said. It shows that, quote, we can do it, and the cheering Iraqi reception is, quote, vindication for the war. And then he launched into a torrent about the Blame America crowd, who just won't go away. And then he asks his faithful listeners, just as we liberated Iraq, we now have to liberate America from the Blame America crowd.
The Bush administration has been very clear that the war in Iraq is the beginning of a series of wars that they would like to wage, and they feel that Iraq will be a starting point. They've talked about regime change throughout the Middle East, and if you look at where the U.S. has positioned its troops in the Philippines, in Colombia, elsewhere in Latin America, in Central Asia, the United States has an agenda right now that they hope to advance through this intervention in Iraq. I think it's very clear to people like Rush Limbaugh and William Safire of the New York Times and the other ideologues supporting this war on Iraq that whatever damage they can do to anti-war forces, whatever lies they can tell about the opposition, whatever they can do to discredit people who marched against this war, who spoke out against this war, will put them in good stead for the next intervention that they wage. But of course, what that involves is a denial of the fact that this war has engendered hostility throughout the world, that this is the most unpopular war that the United States has ever waged, that public opinion polls around the world show that criticism of the United States has increased drastically, and particularly in the Middle East, where the United States would like to achieve other regime changes, they face a much harder challenge, particularly after this war, which most people don't see as a war of liberation or a war of freedom, but as a war of domination and a war of empire, with very good reason.
We have to recognize that a big part of this war this open-ended war on terrorism is the domestic front and is a clampdown on all dissent in this country. When it comes to media, it's not simply the desire to shape your images such that they fit with the line that the administration puts out. So if the administration is saying this is a war of liberation and Iraqis will welcome us with flowers, well, then if you have an image of Iraqis welcoming soldiers, you use that because that fits with what you're saying. And you don't use the images that might raise other questions. We see them around the edges, but that's not the bulk of what you're seeing. Not only is that wrong in the moment, bad reporting, it's going to leave the public extremely confused when, in fact, there is backlash, when, in fact, they learn that not everyone sees things the way the media have told us to see them. Then we are back at, why do they hate us? You know, which, remember, was supposed to be a discussion that we were going to have, and that never happened. You know, so Americans are being coddled by the media to suggest that it's very simple. We're good. Whoever we fight is evil, including people within this country who disagree with the policy. And it's really that simple. Well, it is not that simple, and that will become clear and is clear all the time, but people will not be in a position to even make sense of it because of the way they've been set up to understand this situation. People will say, already were commenting, why are they not welcoming us? You know, we understood, the Iraqi resistance came as a real surprise to much of the public and to many of the pundits that we saw, because we had been told that this would be seen by the Iraqis themselves as a war of liberation. So only transmitting the White House line, besides being propagandistic, it really undermines the public understanding of what's going on. And the media have done that not just by relaying the Bush line, but by these quite savage and sometimes attacks on critics and attacks on dissenters. And it gets back also to the language question that you mentioned. One of the phenomena that we have seen has been the opposition of anti-war people and pro-troop people. Media outlets have, like AP, have used these terms as kind of opposite numbers. You can be anti-war or you can be supporting the troops. Well, many people who are opposed to this war see themselves as supporting troops. They believe they're supporting them by not wanting them to get involved in an illegal war in which they may die and and which is not in any way necessary or healthful, you know. So to say that because you are anti-war, you are not in support of the troops, that's also propaganda, even at the level of language.
Yeah, the point that Janine's making about the media doing a disservice to the public, I think, was particularly clear with the so-called fall of Baghdad, where we saw what Robert Fisk, the British journalist for the Independent newspaper, called the greatest photo op since Iwo Jima. It was clearly a manufactured scene where it was actually Marines, the U.S. Marines, that tore down that statue, and yet it was presented as if it were the equivalent to the people who brought down the Berlin Wall through an act of massive civil disobedience, on their own. It was a handful of Iraqis, of course, who were seen celebrating and who fit the script that we were told would be the immediate script of this war, which is that the moment American soldiers set foot on Iraqi soil, they would be greeted with flowers and that it would be a quick and effortless victory. Of course, that didn't happen, and there's very good reasons for the Iraqi people to have resisted and to have questioned the motives of the United States. But then they seized on that moment to say, we were right, we are being welcomed. And yet the day after that scene in the streets, we saw complete chaos in Baghdad. We saw the suicide bombing of American soldiers. We saw ongoing fighting throughout the country. And we saw that the war, in fact, has not ended. So in reality, the script, it doesn't fit what's happening on the ground in Iraq. And there's a real disjunction. And it gets at the real contradictions between the story that the Bush administration wants the American public to believe about this war and the reality of this war, which is that it is about oil, it is about empire, it is about domination, and there's going to be resistance to that, not only in Iraq, but around the world.
That's the voice of Anthony Arnov. This is Alternative Radio, and we're also joined by Janine Jackson. Our topic today is American Empire and Corporate Media. I'm David Barsamyan. Michael Moore, the author of the best-selling book, Stupid White Men, and the award-winning, Oscar-winning documentary, Bowling for Columbine, doesn't suggest, he explicitly says, that Americans are very frightened people. And that's one of the reasons that there's this enormous attraction to guns. To what extent do you believe that the media promote that kind of feeling of insecurity here in the United States?
I think media play a crucial role in generating a climate of fear and of a desire for defensiveness that allows us to support aggressive policies that people might not otherwise support. It doesn't simply, not simply when we're talking about war, but if you look simply at the coverage of crime in this country, for example. Professor George Gerbner, you know, an eminent media critic, described something called mean world syndrome, which was the fact that people who watched a lot of television in particular believed themselves to be more likely to become a victim of a crime than they actually were in reality, and that in fact those things track one another, your state of fearfulness and how much media you consume. Now the problem with that, besides the obvious one, is also that fear in people leads them, as I say, to support policies that they might not otherwise support. So when we're talking about the war on Iraq, for example, the fact that the media have not fundamentally challenged the connection between Iraq and the September 11th attacks has led to a situation where polls show that many Americans, and in some polls a majority of Americans, believe Iraq to have been somehow, at least partially, responsible for the September 11th attacks. Clearly, that's going to influence and has influenced people's support for the war because they think it has a rationale, a connection, a base that it in fact does not have. I blame media virtually entirely for that. It's clear to me that politicians lie. Politicians have an agenda. They're going to tell the story they want us to hear, and they're going to hide the facts they don't want us to hear. It is emphatically not journalists' job to help them in that effort.
The Bush administration told a number of lies to sell this war, and the Al-Qaeda one is central. But they also were pumping up the idea that Iraq posed a threat to ordinary Americans, that we should be afraid of Saddam Hussein, that we were an embattled country. George Bush, in the final speech he gave before the war began, said it would be suicide not to attack Iraq. Now, the absurdity of that statement is so profound, and yet he was allowed to say it. That speech was quoted verbatim in the press. It was repeated ad nauseum on the television screens, and very little was done to challenge that image of Iraq as a threat, as a country that was gunning down for the United States. The reality is far more complicated. Not only is there no connection between Iraq and September 11th that anyone has been able to prove, but Iraq has no long-range missile capacity. It has a military which is a shadow of what it was in 1991 when the United States was able to crush it in a matter of weeks. And there was no indication that Iraq was forging any connections with any international terrorist groups, let alone Al-Qaeda, to target the United States. And yet, as Janine pointed out, 46% of the U.S. population believed that Iraq was associated with those attacks, and an even higher percentage thought that Iraq was a threat to the United States. That's a clear example of manipulation of public fear and a complete distortion of the reality of the situation. The opposite is actually the case. I think, as Arundhati Roy pointed out very well in an article she wrote for The Guardian, Iraq was a country that has been going through years of disarmament, is a country which is trying to rebuild from the last war, 1991 Gulf War, which left it devastated. It's been subjected to the most comprehensive sanctions that any country has ever been subjected to in history for a period of 12 years. So it is actually the country which is being threatened by the United States, not the reverse.
Tom Brokaw, the noted anchor of NBC Nightly News, made this statement during the early days of the war that we are, quote, not bombing Iraq's infrastructure because pretty soon we're going to own that country, unquote. A rather revealing comment from Brokaw. What did you make of that?
One of the things that happens when there's a blockbuster story and journalists are on for hour after hour is every now and again something slips out that's a little too revealing, I think. Here, after all, the claim that's being made about critics is that they're saying this is a battle of empire, and they're wrong, because actually this is about liberating the Iraqi people. And then here Brokaw makes a slip. It was actually on March 19th, I happen to remember it vividly, that we're going to own that country, which is exactly, of course, the most frightening depiction of the U.S.'s rationale that critics of the war had, and yet it slips out. I am flabbergasted by it on a number of levels. One perhaps small level is the we. This is a problem we often see with journalists who are meant, after all, to not be an arm of the state, but to be independently scrutinizing the actions of the state. So even to hear a media person use the word we, you know, we're going into Basra, we're going to own that country, is already troubling. And then what is there to say about a comment like we're going to own that country? To me, it simply illustrates especially vividly the absolute absence of any recognition of international law that has permeated this media discussion. You have heard this whole idea of a preemptive strike, defensively striking someone who hasn't yet endangered you, which has no basis in international law. That's not a rule. That's not anything that anyone recognizes. And yet, media have sort of adopted it and have said, well, this new preemptive strategy gives Bush the power to do X and Y. Well, if they would interview, it comes back in part to sources. If they would simply allow international law experts some airtime, they could make very clear that there is nothing that allows a preemptive strike, such as the one that the U.S. has done on Iraq. And therefore, comments like Brokaw's are not just offensive, but there really is a lot to be said about them. There's a lot to be said about that being the rationale, the U.S. ownership of Iraq. It's outrageous.
In an article in the International Socialist Review, you cite the National Security Strategy of the United States of America. This is a government document. People can access it at whitehouse.gov. It was published on September 17, 2002, about a year after the events of 9/11. And here's the quote I'd like you to comment on. The events of September, and this is from the document, the events of September 11th, have opened vast new opportunities for the United States. Now, what did you make of that?
Well, it's the most cynical statement of how the United States government is manipulating people's fear, people's anger, people's anxiety over the horrific events of September 11th, 2001. And what's really revealing about it is that this event, which for the rest of us was a tragedy, is seen by them quite explicitly as an opportunity to advance a foreign policy agenda that they had long before the attacks of September 11th and completely independently of September 11th. For example, they're using September 11th to sell the war in Iraq in the way in which Janine discussed trying to link Iraq to Al-Qaeda, but they're doing it in another way as well, which is that they're saying that we will be safer if we go to war with Iraq. We'll be less likely to be targeted by terrorists. The reality is the complete opposite, as they've acknowledged. Top Bush and Blair administration officials have said, no, once we go to war with Iraq, it's more likely that people will target us. It's more likely that there'll be anger and resentment, and that terrorists will strike out not only at the United States, but at U.S.-identified locations internationally. But the other part of the National Security Strategy document that's very important to look at is it says quite openly the Bush administration is pursuing a long-term agenda of war on many fronts, and that it is determined not to allow any peer to emerge on the world stage. In other words, it will prevent any economic or military rival from ever closing the gap that now exists between the United States and every other country in the world. So it's not merely Iraq that's being targeted. It's not merely so-called rogue states that are being targeted. It's Germany. It's China. It's France. It's India. It's any country which could threaten to destabilize U.S. domination of the world system. And they are determined not to allow that to happen. And so that's where, again, we have to talk about oil. We have to talk about empire. We have to talk about what is at stake for the United States in going into Iraq.
this fundamental question, will we be safer after the invasion of Iraq, is one of those basic questions that could be asked. You don't have to be in Baghdad to ask that question. You can be anywhere in the country as a reporter and start digging into that question. And as Anthony has pointed out, there are many, many people you could talk to, including officials, who would indicate that they don't believe that the invasion of Iraq will make us safer and that, in fact, it will make us less safe. So that's a kind of basic question. And the fact that the Bush administration, the long roots of the current foreign policy strategy of the Bush administration have been documented by a number of independent investigative journalists. The information is out there, and yet I believe that most Americans would say that they believe that this whole strategy sprung up as a response to September 11th, simply to get the information out that the administration had plans to go after Iraq before September 11th, would shape people's opinion, I think, would make a difference to people if they could hear that information, if they could hear those perspectives on a regular basis. Some of them might agree. They might agree with this strategy. They might want to support it, but many others might not if they really knew the facts.
For example, just to follow on what Janine is saying, I've not seen the quote that you just read from the National Security Strategy cited in any newspaper account. It's the most horrific statement in the national security strategy. It should be debated. It should be discussed. And yet, we've seen hardly any coverage of the national security strategy document at all. In fact, there's a very interesting history here. The document has a long history. It was written in the early 1990s in early drafts by some of the people who are now quite powerful in the Bush administration. Aspects of that document were leaked in the early 1990s, and there was actually criticism in the media at the time. There was actually criticism internationally that the United States was taking so unilateralist, so militarist a stance, and it was withdrawn. And in fact, the first Bush administration said, no, that wasn't really our thinking. That was just an internal discussion. Now it's public. It's on the White House website. It's there to be downloaded. It's there to be read. And yet no one is talking about this.
Tariq Ali has commented in a way that it's a good thing that they're coming out of the closet, because now people around the world know where to kneel.
The Indian novelist Arundhati Roy made a very similar point. She said the mask is off. We can talk about empire. We can talk about imperialism right now. And it's quite interesting that it's the right that has reintroduced the term imperialism into public discussion. They, of course, think it's a wonderful thing. You have front page magazine articles, such as the New York Times magazine article in January of 2003, where Michael Ignatieff wrote an article which the Times headlined, "The American Empire, Get Used to It." I think it's actually healthy that this is now available for debate and discussion. We're going to have to push, though, to reintroduce this topic into discourse, because particularly with the end of the war in Iraq, we're going to see triumphalist rhetoric, and we're also going to see something that we saw with Afghanistan. The moment that the United States can declare an easy victory, the press will go away, and they won't report on the ongoing problems, the ongoing suffering, the ongoing difficulties, anything that undermines this happy narrative of a quick and easy victory.
Well, let's, if we can, explore a little bit more about the origins of the attack on Iraq. You alluded to it briefly, because it way predates September 11th, 2001. In 92, Paul Wolfowitz, who's now the Deputy Secretary of State of Defense, was then working for Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. He wrote a position paper advocating a regime change in Iraq. A few years later, in 97 to be precise, the Project for a New American Century was launched primarily by William Kristol, the editor of the News Corporation influential weekly called the Weekly Standard, as well as people like Bolton and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl. The following year, they wrote a letter to Clinton advocating war on Iraq and regime change. And interestingly, 10 of the 18 signatories of that letter are now serving in the Bush administration.
Oh, absolutely. This policy goes back to the moment when the United States was unable to achieve regime change in the last Gulf War. The Bush administration at the time would have liked to have been able to impose, in essence, Hussein Light, someone like Saddam Hussein, who the United States had considered their ally, who they had armed and they had supported throughout the 1980s, but someone who would be more properly subordinate and oriented to the United States. When they couldn't find that person, the Bush administration at the time decided that rather than risk a popular uprising that they did not control, rather than risk the country breaking apart in Kurds in the north, in the Shia Muslims in the south, fighting for their own independence, that they would allow Saddam Hussein to stay in power. But from the very moment that that happened, there were people like Pearl, like Wolfowitz, who thought that the United States would be seen as beatable if they did not achieve regime change in Iraq. The neoconservative commentator William Kristol, who is the editor of the Weekly Standard magazine, said that the fact that the United States hadn't marched all the way to Baghdad created what he called, quote, a lack of awe for the United States. So it's no accident that this campaign was called Shock and Awe. It was meant to not only shock and awe Iraqis, but to shock and awe the world and to demonstrate that no one can escape U.S. power.
The very history that you laid out about some of the key players in the administration right now, the fact that these folks do have a history from previous administrations, they're very much on the record with their agenda for regime change in Iraq and with their broader foreign policy agenda around the world. That simple fact is something that reporters could do to improve the debate, improve the discussion. When you are talking about Paul Wolfowitz, tell us about his history. You know, tell us about the background of these folks and put that story together for people. It's not advocacy journalism, even in that sense. It's simply giving the appropriate historical context to present events. And it's simply just the very basic facts that you mentioned, the Project for a New American Century, who those folks were, what they said, what they wanted, and where they are now. This is basic information which, while it may appear in one article somewhere or one TV program once, we're not hearing it echoed again and again and again. And if it were, folks might have some questions about what these folks have in mind.
The other thing that's very important to keep in mind is that if you look at these documents, they speak very openly about control of Middle Eastern oil reserves. They speak very openly about the need to prevent India and China from being able to import more energy from the Middle East, and the fact that by the year 2020, China will have doubled its energy imports from the region, and that the United States does not want to allow them to have independent access to that oil. They speak very openly about expanding military bases abroad. All the things that the left is criticized for raising in discussions about this war are right there in the heart of those documents to be discussed, to be raised, and certainly to be criticized. And yet these people who have had this agenda for many years are not only allowed to influence the Bush administration policy and to get a free pass, but they're relied on as experts, they're relied on as commentators, and frequently, of course, they're given space on the editorial pages as well as, of course, on the news pages of the American media.
Another member of that group, the Project for a New American Century, is the convicted Iran-Contra felon, Elliot Abrams, who now, incidentally, is in charge of the Middle East desk on the National Security Council. The New Yorker magazine is regarded as fairly liberal and has a number of interesting writers that do write for it. It came out in favor of the war. David Remnick wrote a very pro-war editorial. My attention was caught by an article written by Nicholas Lehman on March 31st, in which he interviewed Richard Haass, again, very mainstream, a former Reagan administration official, now a State Department official in the Bush II administration. And he quotes Haass. Haass apparently meets with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on a regular basis. And he asked Rice, this is in July of 2002, he asks Rice, well, you know, he's hearing rumors that, you know, there's something up on Iraq. And Rice, according to Haass, told him the decision has been made on Iraq, don't waste your breath. Now, this is even before, this is months before Bush's UN speech of September 12th, where, you know, he essentially laid down the gauntlet.
Yeah, the record is quite clear. The Bush administration was determined to get this war by any means necessary. And all that we've gone through over the past year is a series of shifts in the propaganda campaign of how they would sell this war to the American public. Would it be around weapons of mass destruction? Would it be around democracy? Would it be around chemical weapons? Would it be around violations of international law? Would it be around democracy? And so we've seen shifting rationale, and I think that's part of the reason why, in fact, there was a high degree of skepticism about the war before it began. But the Bush administration was quite clear, regardless of what the United Nations said, regardless of what international allies said, regardless of the protests on the streets here and around the world, they had staked far too much on this war. Henry Kissinger, the former national security advisor and also war criminal and former Secretary of State, but you know, I think former war criminal is the best way to describe him, said you don't simply move 250,000 American troops into the Middle East and then pull them out. He was very clear that we could not allow the UN or anything else to stand in the way of this war once the ball was rolling, and the ball has been rolling for a very long time. The troops were moved into position, and also, very interestingly, to come back to the theme of this program, it was months before the war began that the United States set up its propaganda operation in Qatar. They dispatched some of their chief PR executives out to that base in anticipation of this war. They knew it was coming. It was just a matter of how quickly they could either get the international community to give a fig leaf of multilateralism, or how long it would be before, once that fig leaf couldn't be engineered, they could get the equipment into place to launch this horrific assault on the Iraqi population.
Janine Jackson, what's your understanding of why there is this enormous gap between American public opinion on invading Iraq and the rest of the world? What kind of information are people getting in Turkey, India, Pakistan, and Japan, for example, that is so different from what we're getting here in the United States?
Well, perhaps it's because I'm a media critic, but I do lay much of the blame for the misinformed and disinformed U.S. public on the, at the media's feet. I think the very, media's presentation of the U.S. as the best with very little challenge to government policies and programs long predates the Iraq invasion. The tendency for journalists to glorify their own government, to not challenge their sources, the simple closeness to power between the corporate media and the administration is a chronic problem in this country. Yes, it's at an extreme height, I think, right now. Cy Hirsch from The New Yorker says he's never seen reporters so frightened as they are right now, so cowed, so afraid of appearing unpatriotic. But that narrow view that we're getting from that corporate media is absolutely the reason that folks in the U.S. don't understand why folks around the world might feel differently about the Iraq invasion or about anything than we do. One hopeful sign is I think the propaganda hand has been so heavy right now that many, many people in the U.S. are recognizing that they have to go outside corporate media to get the full story. So hopefully in the future, they will be better informed, more widely informed, because they are not simply relying on the media at home.
I think there's also a difference in how people experience empire within the empire and how they experience it outside the empire. And many of the people who are questioning this war, who live abroad, have seen firsthand the results of U.S. imperialism, have seen the gap between the rhetoric. You know, U.S. wars have always been fought in the name of freedom and democracy, and yet we've seen around the world what they've really led to: lack of democracy, destruction, devastation, undermining democracy around the world. And so that gap is narrowing, however. I think in the United States, there's increasing awareness, there's increasing discussion about the cost of empire, the cost for people abroad, but also the cost at home, where we're being made to pay a price for this war. The billions of dollars the Bush administration has to bombard other countries are taken away from schools, education, healthcare, and programs that we need here at home.
What sources can you recommend for people to get independent sources of information outside the corporate nexus?
I would suggest folks get on the internet, if at all possible, and try to read the foreign press. Doesn't have to be any one source. It can be British press, French press. Also, those websites like workingforchange.org, like commondreams.org, that cull articles. There's good journalism being done in this country, and there are folks who are trying to put it together in a place that folks can access it. But my main message would be, you have to read widely. You cannot rely on any single outlet, and there is simply no substitute for being an independently informed citizen.
I would also add that Janine's organization puts out an excellent magazine, Extra. Their radio program, Counterspin, is an excellent source of information. And there's also increasing interest in alternative book publication in this country, books by publishers such as South End Press, Seven Stories, City Lights. There's been a real renaissance, I think, in critical literature. Also, magazines that take a critical view of U.S. foreign policy, such as the International Socialist Review, Monthly Review, I think are essential for building this culture of resistance in the United States.
And the website for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting is simply fair.org. That's FAIR.org. I've been talking with Anthony Arnov, who's the editor of the international bestseller, Iraq Under Siege. He lectures frequently on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And also been talking to Janine Jackson, who's the program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting in New York, the New York-based media watch group. Thanks so much for joining us, Anthony Arnov.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Janine Jackson.
Thank you, David.
And you've been listening to American Empire and Corporate Media. This is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This program is produced by AR, an independent award-winning weekly series featuring such voices as Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Edward Said, Rania Masri, Asad Abu Khalil, and Howard Zinn. To access our catalog, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of the program you just heard, American Empire and Corporate Media, just call our toll-free number at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. And from Taos, New Mexico, I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.